"Someone get my sister down!" Esme cried.
Bronwyn went after her. She climbed a crumbling staircase to the ruined ceiling, then reached out to grab onto the beam. She pulled and pulled, and with her great strength was able to angle the beam downward until the broken end was nearly touching the rubble below. This allowed Enoch and Hugh to reach Sam's dangling legs and, very gently, slide her forward until she came free with a soft ploop and landed on her feet. Sam regarded the hole in her chest dully. It was nearly 6 inches in diameter and perfectly round, like the beam she'd been impaled on, and yet it didn't seem to concern her much. Esme broke away from Emma and ran to her sister.
"Sam!"
she cried, throwing her arms around the injured girl's waist.
"Thank heaven you're all right!"
"I don't think she is," Olive said. "I don't think she is at all."
But Sam worried only for Esme, not for herself. Once she'd hugged the stuffing out of her, Sam knelt down and held the little girl at arm's length, scanning for cuts and bruises.
"Tell me where it hurts," she said. "My ears are ringy. I scraped my knees, and I got some dirt in my eye."
Then Esme began to tremble and cry, the shock of what had happened overcoming her again. Sam hugged her close, saying, "There, there." It made no sense that Sam's body was functioning in any capacity. Stranger still, her wound wasn't even bleeding, and there was no gore or little bits of entrails hanging out of it, like I knew to expect from horror movies. Instead, Sam looked like a paper doll that had been attacked with a giant hole punch. Though everyone was dying for an explanation, we had elected to give the girls a moment to themselves and stared in amazement from a respectful distance. Enoch, however, paid them no such courtesy.
"Excuse me," he said, crowding into their personal space, "but could you please explain how it is that you're alive?"
"It's nothing serious," Sam said, "although my dress may not survive."
"Nothing serious?" said Enoch. "I can see clear through you."
"It does smart a little," she admitted, "but it'll fill in a day or so. Things like this always do."
Enoch laughed dementedly.
"Things like this?"
"In the name of all that's peculiar," Millard said quietly, "you know what this means, don't you?"
"She's one of us," I said. We had questions, lots of questions. As Esme's tears began to fade, we worked up the courage to ask them. Did Sam realize she was peculiar? She knew she was different, she said, but had never heard the term peculiar. Had she ever lived in a loop? She had not.
A what?
Which meant she was just as old as she appeared to be. 12, she said. Had no Imbrin ever come to find her?
"Someone came once," she answered. "There were others like me, but to join them I would have had to leave Esme behind."
"Esme can't do anything?" I asked.
"I can count backward from 100 in a duck voice," Esme volunteered through her sniffles, and then began to demonstrate, quacking,
100, 99, 98.
Before she could get any further, Esme was interrupted by a siren, this one high-pitched and moving fast in our direction. An ambulance careened into the alley and raced toward us, its headlights blacked out so that only pinpricks of light shone through. It skidded to a stop nearby, cut its siren, and a driver leapt out.
"Is anyone hurt?"
the driver said, rushing over to us. He wore a rumpled gray uniform and a dented metal hat, and though he was full of energy, his face looked haggard, like he hadn't slept in days. His eyes met the hole in Sam's chest, and he stopped dead in his tracks.
"Gorblimey!"
Sam got to her feet.
"It's nothing, really," she said. "I'm fine."
And to demonstrate how fine she was, she passed her fist in and out of the hole a few times, and did a jumping jack. The medic fainted.
"Hmm," said Hugh, nudging the fallen man with his foot. "You'd think these chaps would be made of tougher stuff. Since he's clearly unfit for service, I say we borrow his ambulance," Enix said. "There's no knowing where in the city that pigeon's leading us. If it's far, it could take us all night to reach Miss Wren on foot."
Horace, who'd been sitting on a chunk of wall, sprang to his feet.
"That's a fine idea," he said. "It's a reprehensible idea," Bronwyn said. "You can't steal an ambulance. Injured persons need it." "We're injured persons," Horace whined. "We need it. It's hardly the same thing."
"Saint Bronwyn," Enix said sarcastically, "are you so concerned with the well-being of normals that you'd risk Miss Peregrine's life to protect a few of theirs? 1,000 of them aren't worth one of her, or one of us, for that matter."
Bronwyn gasped.
"What a thing to say in front of—"
Sam stalked toward Enoch with a humorless look on her face.
"Look here, boy," she said. "If you imply that my sister's life is worthless again, I will clobber you."
"Calm down. I wasn't referring to your sister. I only meant that—"
"I know exactly what you meant, and I'll clobber you if you say it again."
"I'm sorry if I've offended your delicate sensibilities," Enix said, his voice rising in exasperation.
"But you've never had an Imbrin, and you've never lived in a loop, and so you couldn't possibly understand that this, right now, is not real, strictly speaking. It's the past. The life of every normal in this city has already been lived. Their fates are predetermined, no matter how many ambulances we steal. So it doesn't bloody matter, you see?"
Looking a bit baffled, Sam said nothing, but continued to give Enoch the evil eye.
"Even so," said Bronwyn, "it's not right to make people suffer unnecessarily. We can't take the ambulance."
"That's all well and good, but think of Miss Peregrine," said Millard. "She can't have more than a day left."
Our group seemed evenly divided between stealing the ambulance or going on foot, so we put it to a vote. I myself was against taking it, but mostly because the roads were so pocked with bomb holes that I didn't know how we'd drive the thing. Emma took the vote.
"Who's for taking the ambulance?" she said.
A few hands shot up.
"And against?"
Suddenly, there was a loud pop from the direction of the ambulance, and we all turned to see Miss Peregrine standing by as one of its rear tires hissed air. Miss Peregrine had voted with her beak by stabbing it into the ambulance's tire. Now, no one could use it. Not us, not injured persons, and there was no point in arguing or delaying any further.
"Well, that simplifies things," said Millard. "We go on foot."
"Miss Peregrine," Bronwyn cried. "How could you?"
Ignoring Bronwyn's indignation, Miss Peregrine hopped over to Melina, looked up at the pigeon on her shoulder, and screeched. The message was clear.
"Let's go already!"
What could we do? Time was wasting.
"Come with us," Emma said to Sam. "If there's any justice in the world, we'll be somewhere safe before the night is through." "I told you, I won't leave my sister behind," Sam replied. "You're going to one of those places she can't enter, aren't you?"
I don't know," Emma stammered. "It's possible."
"I don't care either way," Sam said coldly. "After what I just saw, I wouldn't so much as cross the road with you."
Emma drew back, going a bit pale. In a small voice, she asked,
"Why?"
"If even outcasts and downtrodden folk like yourselves can't muster a bit of compassion for others," she said, "then there's no hope for this world."
And she turned away and carried Esme toward the ambulance. Emma reacted as if she'd been slapped, her cheeks going red. She ran after Sam.
"We don't all think the way Enoch does.
And as for our Imbrin, I'm sure she didn't mean to do what she did.
Sam spun to face her.
That was no accident. I'm glad my sister's not like all of you. Wish to God I wasn't.
She turned away again, and this time Emma didn't follow. With wounded eyes, she watched Sam go, then slouched after the others. Somehow the olive branch she'd extended had turned into a snake and bitten her. Bronwyn peeled off her sweater and set it down on the rubble.
Next time bombs start falling, have your sister wear this, she called to Sam. It'll keep her safer than any bathtub.
Sam said nothing, didn't even look. She was bending over the ambulance driver, who was sitting up now and mumbling,
I had the queerest dream.
That was a stupid thing to do, Enoch said to Bronwyn. Now you don't have a sweater. Shut your fat gob, Bronwyn replied. If you'd ever done a nice thing for another person, you might understand. I did do something nice for another person, Enoch said, and it nearly got us eaten by hollows.
We mumbled goodbyes that went unreturned and slipped quietly into the shadows. Melina took the pigeon from her shoulder and tossed it skyward. It flew a short distance before a string she'd tied around its foot snapped taut, and it hovered, caught in the air, like a dog straining at its lead.
Miss Wren's this way,
Melina said, nodding in the direction the bird was pulling, and we followed the girl and her pigeon friend down the alley. I was about to assume Hollow Watch, my now customary position near the head of the group, when something made me glance back at the sisters. I turned in time to see Sam lift Esme into the ambulance, then bend forward to plant a kiss on each of her scraped knees. I wondered what would happen to them. Later, Millard would tell me that the fact that none of them had ever heard of Sam, and someone with such a unique peculiarity would have been well known, meant she probably had not survived the war. The whole episode had really gotten to Emma. I don't know why it was so important for her to prove to a stranger that we were good-hearted when we knew ourselves to be, but the suggestion that we were anything less than angels walking the earth, that our natures were more complexly shaded, seemed to bother her.
They don't understand, she kept saying.
Then again, I thought, maybe they do. Chapter 11. So it had come to this. Everything depended on a pigeon. Whether we would end the night in the womb-like safety of an Imbrin's care, or half-chewed in the churning black of a hollow's guts. Whether Miss Peregrine would be saved, or we'd wander lost through this hellscape until her clock ran out. Whether I would live to see my home or my parents again, it all depended on one scrawny, peculiar pigeon. I walked at the front of the group, feeling for hollows, but it was really the pigeon who led us, tugging on its leash like a bloodhound after a scent. We turned left when the bird flew left, and right when it jerked right, obedient as sheep even when it meant fumbling down streets cratered with ankle-breaking bomb holes, or bristling with the bones of dismembered buildings, their jagged iron spear tips lurking dimly in the wavering fire glow, angled at our throats. Coming down from the terrifying events of that evening, I'd reached a new low of exhaustion. My head tingled strangely, my feet dragged. The rumble of bombs had quieted, and the sirens had finally wound down, and I wondered if all that apocalyptic noise had been keeping me awake. Now the smoky air was alive with subtler sounds, water gushing from broken mains, the whine of a trapped dog, hoarse voices moaning for help. Occasionally fellow travelers would materialize out of the dark. Wraith-like figures escaped from some lower world, eyes shining with fear and suspicion, clutching random things in their arms, radios, looted silver, a gilt box, a funerary urn. dead, bearing the dead. We came to a T in the road and stopped, the pigeon deliberating between left and right. The girl murmured encouragements.
Come on, Winnie. There's a good pigeon. Show us away.
Enoch leaned in and whispered, If you don't find Miss Wren, I will personally roast you on a spit. The bird leapt into the air, urging left. Melina glowered at Enoch.
You're an arse, she said.
I get results, he replied.
Eventually we arrived at an underground station. The pigeon led us through its arched entry into a ticket lobby, and I was about to say, We're taking the subway, smart bird, when I realized the lobby was deserted and the ticket booth shuttered. Though it didn't look like trains would be visiting this station any time soon, we forged ahead regardless, through an unchained gate, along a hallway lined with peeling notices and chipped white tiles, to a deep staircase where we spiraled down and down into the city's humming, electric-lit belly. At each landing, we had to step around sleeping people wrapped in blankets, lone sleepers at first, then groups lying like scattered matchsticks, and then, as we reached bottom, an unbroken human tide that swept across the underground platform. Hundreds of people squeezed between a wall and the tracks, curled on the floor, sprawled on benches, sunk into folding chairs. Those who weren't sleeping rocked babies in their arms, read paperbacks, played cards, prayed. They weren't waiting for a train. No trains were coming. They were refugees from the bombs, and this was their shelter. I tried sensing for hollows, but there were too many faces, too many shadows. Luck, if we had any left, would have to sustain us for a while.
Now what?
We needed directions from the pigeon, but it seemed briefly confused. Like me, it was probably overwhelmed by the crowd. So we stood and waited, the breaths and snores and mumbles of the sleepers murmuring weirdly around us. After a minute, the pigeon stiffened and flew toward the tracks, then reached the end of its leash and bounced back into Melina's hand like a yo-yo. We tiptoed around the bodies to the edge of the platform, then hopped down into the pit where the tracks ran. They disappeared into tunnels on either end of the station. I had a sinking feeling that our future lay somewhere inside one of these dark, gaping mouths.
"Oh, I hope we don't have to go mucking about in there," said Olive.
"Of course we do," Enoch said. "It isn't a proper holiday until we've plumbed every available sewer."
The pigeon bopped rightward. We started down the tracks. I hopscotched around an oily puddle and a legion of rats scurried away from my feet, sending Olive into Bronwyn's arms with a shriek. The tunnel yawned before us, black and menacing. It occurred to me that this would be a very bad place to meet a hollowgast. Here there'd be no walls to climb, no houses to shelter in, no tomb lids to close behind us. It was long and straight, and lit only by a few red bulbs, glinting feebly at scattered intervals. I walked faster. The darkness closed around us.
When I was a kid, I used to play hide-and-seek with my dad. I was always the hider and he the seeker. I was really good at it, primarily because I, unlike most kids of 4 or 5, had the then peculiar ability to be extremely quiet for long periods of time, and also because I suffered from absolutely no trace of anything resembling claustrophobia, I could wedge myself into the smallest rear closet crawl space and stay there for 20 or 30 minutes, not making a sound, having the time of my life. Which is why you'd think I wouldn't have a problem with the whole dark, enclosed spaces thing. Or why, at the very least, you'd think a tunnel meant to contain trains and tracks and nothing else would be easier for me to handle than one that was essentially an open cemetery,
with all manner of Halloweenish things spilling out along it. And yet, the farther into this tunnel we walked, the more I was overcome by clammy, creeping dread, a feeling entirely apart from the one I sensed Hollows with. This was simply a bad feeling. And so I hurried us through as fast as the slowest of us could go, prodding Melina until she barked at me to back off, a steady drip of adrenaline keeping my deep exhaustion at bay. After a long walk and several Y-shaped tunnel splits, the pigeon led us to a disused section of track where the ties had warped and rotted, and pools of stagnant water spanned the floor. The pressure of trains passing in far-off tunnels pushed the air around like breaths in some great creature's gullet. Then, way down ahead of us, a pinpoint of light winked into being, small but growing fast. Emma shouted, "Train!" And we split apart and pressed our backs to the walls. I covered my ears, expecting a deafening roar of a train engine at close range, but it never came. All I could hear was a small, high-pitched whine, which I was fairly certain was coming from inside my own head. Just as the light was filling the tunnel, its white glow surrounding us, I felt a sudden pressure in my ears, and the light disappeared. We stumbled away from the walls in a daze. Now the tracks and ties under our feet were new, as if they'd just been laid. The tunnel smelled somewhat less intensely of urine. The bulbs along it had gotten brighter, and instead of giving a steady light, they flickered, because they weren't electric bulbs at all, but gas lamps. "What just happened?" I said. "We crossed into a loop," said Emma. "But what was that light? I've never seen anything like that."
"Every loop entrance has its quirks," said Millard. "Anyone know when we are?" I asked.
"I'd guess the latter half of the 19th century," said Millard. "Prior to 1863 there wasn't an underground system in London at all."
Then, from behind us, another light appeared, this one accompanied by a gust of hot wind and a thunderous roar.
"Train!"
Emma shouted again, and this time it really was. We threw ourselves against the walls as it shot past in a cyclone of noise and light and belching smoke. It looked less like a modern subway train than a miniature locomotive. It even had a caboose, where a man with a big black beard and a guttering lantern in his hand gaped at us in surprise as the train strafed away around the next bend. Hugh's cap had blown off his head and been crushed. He went to pick it up, found it shredded, and threw it down again angrily.
"I don't care for this loop," he said. "We've been here all of 10 seconds, and already it's trying to kill us. Let's do what we have to and get gone."
"I couldn't agree more," said Enoch.
The pigeon guided us on down the track. After 10 minutes or so, it stopped, pulling toward what looked like a blank wall. We couldn't understand why, until I looked up and noticed a partially camouflaged door where the wall met the ceiling, 20 feet overhead. Because there seemed no other way to reach it, Olive took off her shoes and floated up to get a closer look.
"There's a lock on it," she said. "A combination lock."
There was also a pigeon-sized hole rusted through the door's bottom corner, but that was no help to us. We needed the combination.
"Any idea what it could be?" Emma asked, putting the question out to everyone.
She was met with shrugs and blank looks.
"None," said Millard.
"We'll have to guess," she said. "Perhaps it's my birthday," said Enoch. "Try 3/12/92.
"Why would anyone know your birthday?" said Hugh.
Enoch frowned.
"Just try it."
Olive spun the dial back and forth, then tried the lock.
"Sorry, Enoch."
"What about our loop day?" Horace suggested.
9/3/40.
That didn't work either.
"It's not going to be something easy to guess like a date,"
said Millard. That would defeat the purpose of having a lock. Olive began to try random combinations. We stood by, watching, growing more anxious with each failed attempt. Meanwhile, Miss Peregrine slipped quietly from Bronwyn's coat and hopped over to the pigeon, who was waddling around at the end of its lead, pecking at the ground. When it saw Miss Peregrine, it tried to hop away, but the headmistress followed, making a low, vaguely threatening warble in her throat. The pigeon flapped its wings and flew up to Melina's shoulder, out of Miss Peregrine's reach. Miss Peregrine stood by Melina's feet, squawking at it. This seemed to make the pigeon extremely nervous.
"Miss P., what are you up to?" said Emma.
"I think she wants something from your bird," I said to Melina.
"If the pigeon knows the way," said Millard, "perhaps it knows the combination, too."
Miss Peregrine turned toward him and squawked, then looked back at the pigeon and squawked louder. The pigeon tried to hide behind Melina's neck.
"Perhaps the pigeon knows the combination, but doesn't know how to tell us," said Bronwyn. "But it could tell Miss Peregrine, because both of them speak bird language, and then Miss Peregrine could tell us."
"Make your pigeon talk to our bird," said Enoch.
"Your bird's twice when he sighs and sharp on three ends," Melina said, backing away a step. "She's scared, and I don't blame her."
"There's nothing to be scared of," said Emma. "Miss P. would never hurt another bird. It's against the Imbrin code."
Melina's eyes widened, then narrowed.
"That bird is an Imbrin?"
"She's our head mistress," said Bronwyn. "Alma Le Fay Peregrine."
"Full of surprises, ain't you?"
Melina said, then laughed in a way that wasn't exactly friendly.
"If you've got an Imbrin right there, what do you need to find another one for?"
"It's a long story," said Millard. "Suffice to say, our Imbrin needs help that only another Imbrin can give."
"Just put the blasted pigeon on the ground so Miss P. can talk to it," said Enoch.
Finally, reluctantly, Melina agreed.
"Come on, Winnie. There's a good girl."
She lifted the pigeon from her shoulder and placed it gently at her feet, then pinned its leash under her shoe so it couldn't fly away. Everyone circled around to watch as Miss Peregrine advanced on the pigeon. It tried to run but was caught short by the leash. Miss Peregrine got right in its face, warbling and clucking. It was like watching an interrogation. The pigeon tucked its head under its wing and began to tremble. Then Miss Peregrine pecked it on the head.
"Hey!" said Melina. "Stop that!"
The pigeon kept its head tucked and didn't respond, so Miss Peregrine pecked it again, harder.
"That's enough!"
Melina said, and lifting her shoe from the leash, she reached down for the pigeon. Before she could get her fingers around it, though, Miss Peregrine severed the leash with a quick slash of her talons, clamped down with her beak on one of the pigeon's twiggy legs, and bounded away, the pigeon screeching and flailing. Melina freaked out.
"Come back here!"
she shouted, furious, about to run after the birds when Bronwyn caught her by the arms.
"Wait!" said Bronwyn. "I'm sure Miss P. knows what she's doing."
Miss Peregrine stopped a little way down the track, well out of anyone's reach. The pigeon struggled in her beak, and Melina struggled against Bronwyn, both in vain. Miss Peregrine seemed to be waiting for the pigeon to tire out and give up, but then she got impatient and began swinging the pigeon around in the air by its leg.
"Please, Miss P.," Olive shouted. "You'll kill it!"
I was close to rushing over and breaking it up myself, but the birds were a blur of talons and beaks, and no one could get close enough to separate them. We yelled and begged Miss Peregrine to stop. Finally, she did. The pigeon dropped from her mouth and wobbled on its feet, too stunned to flee. Miss Peregrine warbled at it the way she had earlier, and this time the pigeon chirped in response. Then Miss Peregrine tapped the ground with her beak three times,
then 10 times, then 5. 3, 10, 5. Olive tried the combination. The lock popped open, the door swung inward, and a rope ladder unrolled down the wall to meet the floor. Miss Peregrine's interrogation had worked. She'd done what she needed to do to help us all, and given that, we might have overlooked her behavior, if not for what happened next. She took the dazed pigeon by its leg again and, seemingly out of spite, flung it hard against the wall. We reacted with a great collective gasp of horror. I was shocked beyond speaking. Melina broke away from Bronwyn and ran to pick up the pigeon. It hung limply from her hand, its neck broken.
"Oh, my bird! She's killed it!" cried Melina.
"All we went through to catch that thing," said Hugh. "And now look."
"I'm going to stomp your Imbrin's head!"
Melina shrieked, crazed with rage. Bronwyn caught her arms again.
"No, you're not! Stop it! Your Imbrin's a savage! If that's how she conducts herself, we're better off with the whites!"
"You take that back!" shouted Hugh.
"I won't!"
Melina said. More harsh words were exchanged. A fist fight was narrowly avoided. Bronwyn held Melina, and Emma and I held Hugh until the fight went out of them, if not the bitterness. No one could quite believe what Miss Peregrine had done.
"What's the big fuss?" said Enoch. "It was just a stupid pigeon."
"No, it wasn't," said Emma, scolding Miss Peregrine directly. "That bird was a personal friend of Miss Wren's. It was hundreds of years old. It was written about in the tales. And now it's dead."
"Murdered," said Melina,
and she spat on the ground.
"That's what it's called when you kill something for no reason."
Miss Peregrine nibbled casually at a mite under her wing, as if she hadn't heard any of this.
"Something wicked's gotten into her," said Olive. "This isn't like Miss Peregrine at all."
"She's changing," said Hugh. "Becoming more animal."
"I hope there's still something human left in her to rescue," Millard said darkly.
So did we all. We climbed out of the tunnel, each of us lost in our own anxious thoughts. Beyond the door was a passage that led to a flight of steps that led to another passage and another door, which opened onto a room filled with daylight and packed to the rafters with clothes, racks and closets and wardrobes stuffed with them. There were also two wooden privacy screens to change behind, some freestanding mirrors, and a work table laid out with sewing machines and bolts of raw fabric. It was half boutique, half workshop, and a paradise to Horace, who practically cartwheeled inside, crying,
"I'm in heaven!"
Melina lurked sullenly at the rear, not speaking to anyone.
"What is this place?" I asked.
"It's a disguising room," Millard answered, "designed to help visiting peculiars blend in with this loop's normals."
He pointed out a framed illustration demonstrating how clothes of the period were worn.
"When in Rome,"
said Horace, bounding toward a rack of clothes. Emma asked everyone to change. In addition to helping us blend in, new clothes might also throw off any whites who'd been tracking us.
"But keep your sweaters on underneath, in case more trouble finds us."
Bronwyn and Olive took some plain-looking dresses behind a screen. I traded my ash-coated, sweat-stained pants and jacket for a mismatched but relatively clean suit. Instantly uncomfortable, I wondered how, for so many centuries, people wore such stiff, formal clothes all the time. Millard put on a sharp-looking outfit and sat down in front of a mirror.
"How do I look?" he said.
"Like an invisible boy wearing clothes," replied Horace.
Millard sighed, lingered in front of the mirror a bit longer, then stripped and disappeared again. Horace's initial excitement had already waned.
The selection here is atrocious, he complained. If the clothes aren't moth-eaten, they're patched with clashing fabric. I am so weary of looking like a street urchin.
Street urchins blend, Emma said from behind her changing screen. Little gents in top hats do not.
She emerged wearing shiny red flats and a short-sleeved blue dress that fell just below the knee.
What do you think? She said, twirling to make the dress billow.
She looked like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, only cuter. I didn't know how to tell her this in front of everybody, though, so instead I gave her an awkward grin and a thumbs up. She laughed.
Like it? Well, that's too bad, she said with a coy smile. I'd stick out like a sore thumb.
Then a pained expression crossed her face, as if she felt guilty for laughing, for having had even a moment of fun, given all that had happened to us, and everything yet to be resolved. And she ducked behind the screen again. I felt it, too. The dread, the weight of the horrors we'd seen, which replayed themselves in an endless, lurid loop in my mind. But you can't feel bad every second, I wanted to tell her. Laughing doesn't make bad things worse any more than crying makes them better. It doesn't mean you don't care or that you've forgotten. It just means you're human. But I didn't know how to say this either. When she came out again, she had on a sack-like blouse with ripped sleeves and a broomstick skirt that brushed the top of her feet, much more urchin-like. She'd kept the red shoes, though. Emma could never resist a touch of glitter, however small.
"And this?" said Horace, waving a poofy orange wig he'd found. "How's this going to help anyone blend in with the normals?"
"Because it seems we're going to a carnival," said Hugh, looking up at a poster on the wall that advertised one.
"Just a moment,"
Horace said, joining Hugh beneath the poster.
"I've heard of this place. It's an old tourist loop."
"What's a tourist loop?" I asked.
"Used to be you could find them all across Peculiardom," Millard explained. "Placed strategically at times and locations of historical import. They made up a sort of grand tour that was once considered an essential part of any well-bred Peculiar's education. This was many years ago, of course, when it was still relatively safe to travel abroad. I didn't realize there were any left."
Then he got quiet, lost in memories of a better time. When we'd all finished changing, we left our 20th-century clothes in a heap and followed Emma through another door, out into an alleyway stacked with trash and empty crates. I recognized the sounds of a carnival in the distance, the arrhythmic wheeze of pipe organs, the dull roar of a crowd. Even through my nerves and exhaustion, I felt a jangle of excitement. Once, this was something Peculiars had come from far and wide to see. My parents had never even taken me to Disney World. Emma gave the usual instructions.
"Stay together, watch Jacob and me for signals. Don't talk to anyone, and look no one in the eye."
"How will we know where to go?"
asked Olive. "We'll have to think like Imbrins," Emma said. "If you were Miss Wren, where would you be hiding?"
"Anywhere but London," said Enoch.
"If only someone hadn't murdered the pigeon," Bronwyn said, staring bitterly at Miss Peregrine.
The headmistress stood on the cobblestones looking up at us, but no one wanted to touch her. We had to keep her out of sight, though, so Horace went back into the disguising room and fetched a denim sack. Miss Peregrine wasn't enthusiastic about this arrangement, but when it became clear that no one was going to pick her up, least of all Bronwyn, who seemed entirely disgusted with her, she climbed inside and let Horace knot the top closed with a strip of leather. We followed the drunken sound of the carnival through a snarl of cramped lanes, where from wooden carts vendors hawked vegetables and dusty sacks of grain and freshly killed rabbits, where children and thin cats skulked and prowled with hungry eyes, and women with proud, dirty faces squatted in the gutter peeling potatoes, building little mountains with the tossed-away skins. Though we tried very hard to slink by unnoticed, every one of them seemed to turn and stare as we passed, the vendors, the children, the women, the cats, the dead milk-eyed rabbits swinging by their legs. Even in my new period-appropriate clothes, I felt transparently out of place. Blending in was as much about performance as about costume, I realized, and my friends and I carried ourselves with none of the slump-shouldered, shifty-eyed attitude that these people did. In the future, if I wanted to disguise myself as effectively as the whites, I'd have to sharpen my acting skills. The carnival grew louder as we went, and the smells stronger. Overcooked meats, roasting nuts, horse manure, human manure, and the smoke from coal fires, all mixing together into something so sickly sweet that it thickened the very air. Finally, we reached a wide square where the carnival was in full, rollicking swing, packed with masses of people in brightly colored tents, and more activity than my eyes could take in at once. The whole scene was an assault on my senses. There were acrobats and rope dancers and knife throwers and fire eaters and street performers of every type. A quack doctor pitched patent medicines from the back of a wagon, a rare cordial to fortify the innards against ineffective parasites, unwholesome damps, and malignant effluvia. Competing for attention on an adjacent stage was a loud-mouthed showman in coattails and a large, prehistoric-looking creature whose gray skin hung from its frame in cascading wrinkles. It took me 10 full seconds as we threaded the crowd past the stage to recognize it as a bear. It had been shaved and tied to a chair and made to wear a woman's dress, and as its eyes bulged in its head, the showman grinned and pretended to serve it tea, shouting, "Ladies and gentlemen, presenting the most beautiful lady in all of Wales," which earned him a big laugh from the crowd. I half hoped it would break its chains and eat him right there in front of everyone. To combat the dizzying effect of all this dreamlike madness, I reached into my pocket to palm the smooth glass of my phone, eyes closed for a moment, and whispered to myself, "I am a time traveler. This is real. I, Jacob Portman, am traveling in time." This was astonishing enough. More astonishing, perhaps, was the fact that time travel hadn't broken my brain, that by some miracle I had not yet devolved into a gibbering crazy person ranting on a street corner. The human psyche was much more flexible than I'd imagined, capable of expanding to contain all sorts of contradictions and seeming impossibilities. Lucky for me.
"Olive!" Bronwyn shouted. "Get away from there!"
I looked up to see her yank Olive away from a clown who had bent down to talk to her.
"I've told you time and again, never talk to normals."
Our group was large enough that keeping it together could be a challenge, especially in a place like this, full of distractions tailor-made to fascinate children. Bronwyn acted as den mother, rounding us up every time one of us strayed to get a closer look at a stall of brightly colored pinwheels or steaming boiled candy. Olive was the most easily distractible and often seemed to forget that we were in serious danger. It was only possible to keep so many kids in line because they were not actually kids, because there was some older nature inside them, warring against and balancing their childish impulses. With actual children, I'm sure it would have been hopeless. For a while we wandered aimlessly, looking for anyone who resembled Miss Wren, or anywhere it seemed peculiars were likely to hide. But everything here seemed peculiar. This entire loop, with all its chaotic strangeness, was perfect camouflage for peculiars. And yet, even here, people noticed us, their heads turning subtly as we passed. I started to get paranoid. How many of the people around us were spies for the whites, or whites themselves? I was especially wary of the clown, the one Bronwyn had pulled Olive away from. He kept turning up. We must have passed him 5 times in as many minutes, loitering at the mouth of an alley, staring down from a window, watching us from a tented photo booth, his mussed hair and horrific makeup clashing bizarrely with a backdrop painting of bucolic countryside. He seemed to be everywhere at once. "It's not good being out in the open like this," I said to Emma. "We can't just circle around forever. People are noticing us. Clowns."
"Clowns?" she said.
"Anyway, I agree with you, but it's difficult to know where to start in all this madness.
We should start at what is always the most peculiar part of any carnival," said Enoch, butting between us. "The sideshow."
He pointed at a tall, gaudy facade at the edge of the square.
"Sideshows and peculiars go together like milk and cookies, or hollows and whites."
"Usually they do," said Emma. "But the whites know that as well. I'm sure Miss Wren hasn't kept her freedom this long by hiding in such obvious places."
"Have you got a better idea?" said Enoch.
We didn't, and so we shifted direction toward the sideshow. I looked back for the leering clown, but he had melted into the crowd. At the sideshow, a scruffy carnival barker was shouting through a megaphone, promising glimpses of "the most shocking errors of nature allowed on view by law" for a trivial fee. It was called the Congress of Human Oddities.
"Sounds like dinner parties I've attended," said Horace.
"Some of these oddities might be peculiar," said Millard, "in which case they might know something about Miss Wren. I say it's worth the price of admission."
"We don't have the price of admission," said Horace, pulling a single lint-flecked coin from his pocket.
"Since when have we ever paid to get into a sideshow?" said Enoch.
We followed Enoch around to the back of the sideshow, where its wall-like facade gave way to a big, flimsy tent. We were scouting for openings to slip through, when a flap pulled back, and a well-dressed man and woman burst out, the man holding the lady fanning herself.
"Move aside!" the man barked. "This woman needs air!"
A sign above the flap read, "Performers only." We slipped inside and were immediately stopped. A plain-looking boy sat on a tufted stool near the entrance, apparently in some official capacity.
"You performers," he said, "can't come in unless you're performers."
Feigning offense, Emma said,
"Of course we're performers."
And to demonstrate, she made a tiny flame on the tip of her finger and stubbed it out in her eye. The boy shrugged, unimpressed.
"Go on, then."
We shuffled past him, blinking, our eyes adjusting slowly to the dark. The sideshow was a low-ceilinged maze of canvas, a single dramatically torchlit aisle that took sharp turns every 20 or 30 feet, so that around each corner we were confronted by a new abomination of nature. A trickle of spectators, some laughing, others pale and shaking, stumbled past us in the opposite direction. The first few freaks were standard-issue sideshow fare, and not especially peculiar. An illustrated man covered in tattoos, a bearded lady stroking her long chin whiskers and cackling, a human pincushion who pierced his face with needles and drove nails into his nostrils with a hammer. While I thought this was pretty impressive, my friends, some of whom had traveled Europe in a sideshow with Miss Peregrine, could hardly stifle their yawns. Under a banner that read, "The Amazing Matchstick Men," a gentleman with hundreds of matchbooks glued to his suit body-slammed a man similarly clothed in matchsticks, causing flames to erupt across the matchstick man's chest as he flailed in fake terror.
"Amateurs," Emma muttered as she pulled us on to the next attraction.
The oddities got progressively odder. There was a girl in a long, fringed dress who wore a giant python around her body, which wriggled and danced at her command. Emma allowed that this was at least marginally peculiar, since the ability to enchant snakes was something only Sindragosti could do. But when Emma mentioned Miss Wren to the girl, she gave us a hard stare, and her snake hissed and showed its fangs, and we moved on.
"This is a waste of time," said Enoch. "Miss Peregrine's clock is running out, and we're touring a carnival. Why not get some sweets and make a day of it?"
There was only one more freak to see, though, so we continued on. The final stage was empty but for a plain backdrop, a small table with flowers on it, and an easel-propped sign that read, "The World-Famous Folding Man." A stagehand walked onto the stage, lugging a suitcase. He set the case down and left. A crowd gathered. The suitcase sat there, center stage. People began to shout, "On with the show!" and "Bring out the freak!" The suitcase jiggled, then it began to shake, wobbling back and forth until it toppled onto its side. The crowd pressed toward the stage, fixated on the case. Its latches popped, and very slowly, the case began to open. A pair of white eyes peeped out at the crowd, and then the case opened a little more to reveal a face, that of an adult man with a neatly trimmed mustache and little round glasses, who had somehow folded himself into a suitcase no larger than my torso. The crowd burst into applause, which increased as the freak proceeded to unfold himself, limb by limb, and step out of the impossibly small case. He was very tall and as skinny as a beanpole, so alarmingly thin, in fact, that it looked as if his bones were about to break through his skin. He was a human exclamation point, but carried himself with such dignity that I couldn't laugh at him. He studied the hooting crowd dourly before taking a deep bow. He then took a minute to demonstrate how his limbs could bend in all sorts of exotic ways, his knee twisting so that the top of his foot touched his hip, then his hips folding so that the knee touched his chest, and after more applause and more bows, the show was over. We lingered as the crowd filtered away. The folding man was leaving the stage when Emma said to him, "You're peculiar, aren't you?" The man stopped. He turned slowly to look at her with an air of imperious annoyance.
"Excuse me?" he said in a thick Russian accent.
"Sorry to corner you this way, but we need to find Miss Wren," Emma said. "We know she's here someplace."
"Pah!"
said the man, dismissing her with a noise halfway between laughing and hawking spit.
"It's an emergency," Bronwyn pleaded.
The folding man crossed his arms in a bony X and said,
"I don't know anything what you say,"
then walked off the stage.
"Now what?" asked Bronwyn. "We keep looking," said Emma. "And if we don't find Miss Wren?" said Enoch. "We keep looking," Emma said through her teeth. "Everyone understand?"
Everyone understood perfectly well. We were out of options. If this didn't work, if Miss Wren wasn't here or we couldn't find her soon, then all our efforts would have been for nothing, and Miss Peregrine would be lost just the same as if we'd never come to London at all. We walked out of the sideshow the way we'd come, dejected, past the now empty stages, past the plain-looking boy, out of the tent, and into the daylight. We were standing outside the exit, unsure what to do next, when the plain-looking boy leaned out through the flap.
"What's the trouble?" he said. "Show weren't to your liking?"
"It was fine," I said, waving him off.
"Not peculiar enough for you?" he asked.
That got our attention.
"What did you say?" said Emma.
"Wakeling in Rookery," he said,
pointing past us toward the far side of the square.
"That's where the real show is."
And then he winked at us and ducked back inside the tent.
"That was mysterious," said Hugh.
"Did he say peculiar?" said Bronwyn.
"What's Wakeling and Rookery?" I said.
"A place," said Horace. "Some place in this loop, maybe."
"Could be the intersection of two streets," said Emma, and she pulled back the tent flap to ask the boy if this was what he meant, but he was already gone. So we set off through the crowd, toward the far end of the square where he'd pointed, our one last thin hope pinned to a couple of oddly named streets we weren't even sure existed. There was a point, a few blocks beyond the square, where the noise of the crowd faded and was replaced by an industrial clank and clamor, and the rich funk of roasting meat and animal waste was replaced by a stench far worse and unnameable. Crossing a walled river of Stygian sludge, we entered a district of factories and workhouses, of smokestacks belching black stuff into the sky, and this is where we found Wakeling Street. We walked one way down Wakeling looking for Rookery, until it dead-ended at a large open sewer which Enoch said was the River Fleet, then turned and came back the other way. When we'd passed the point along Wakeling where we'd started, the street began to curve and twist, the factories and workhouses shrinking down into squat offices and unassuming buildings with blank faces and no signs, like a neighborhood purpose-built to be anonymous. The bad feeling I'd been nursing got worse. What if we'd been set up, sent to this deserted part of the city to be ambushed out of view? The street twisted and straightened again, and then I crashed into Emma, who'd been walking in front of me, but had come to a sudden stop. "What's the matter?" I said. In lieu of an answer, she just pointed. Up ahead, at a T-shaped intersection, there was a crowd. Though it had been sticky hot back at the carnival, many of them were bundled in coats and scarves. They were assembled around a particular building and stood gazing up at it in dumbfounded wonder, just as we were now. The building itself was nothing special, four stories, the top three just rows of narrow rounded windows like an old office building. It was, in fact, nearly identical to all the buildings around it, with one exception. It was totally encased in ice. Ice coated its windows and doors. Icicles hung like fangs from every sill and ledge. Snow spilled from its doorways, collecting in giant heaps on the sidewalk. It looked like a blizzard had struck the building from the inside. I peered at a snow-blasted street sign. R. Curie Street.
"I know this place," said Melina. "It's the peculiar archives, where all our official records are kept."
"How do you know that?" said Emma.
"Miss Thrush was grooming me to be second assistant to the ombudswoman there. The examination's very difficult. I've been studying for 21 years.
"Is it supposed to be covered in ice like that?" asked Bronwyn.
"Not that I'm aware," said Melina.
"It's also where the Council of Imbrins convened for the annual nitpicking of the bylaws," said Millard.
"The Council of Imbrins meets here," said Horace. "It's awfully humble. I expected a castle of some sort."
"It's not meant to stand out," said Melina. "You aren't supposed to notice it at all."
"They're doing a poor job of keeping it hidden, then," said Enoch. "As I said, it's not usually covered in ice."
"What do you think happened here?" I asked. "Nothing good," said Millard. "Nothing good at all." There was no question we'd have to get closer and explore, but that didn't mean we had to rush in like fools. We hung back and watched from a distance. People came and went. Someone tried the door, but it was frozen shut. The crowd thinned a bit.
"Tick, tick, tick," said Enoch. "We're wasting time."
We cut through what was left of the crowd and stepped onto the icy sidewalk. The building emanated cold, and we shivered and jammed our hands into our pockets against it. Bronwyn used her strength to pull open the door, and it came straight off, hinges flying, but the hallway it led onto was completely obstructed by